And you're listening to yet another episode of A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. I'm here with Dave Douglas, and my name is Michael Bates.
Welcome back. Nice to be here. We're going to be talking to Myra Melford today and listening to her music. And Michael has some more crazy future inventions, and I have some thoughts about street performing. So here we go.
Myra Melford, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Bates is here too.
Hey, Myra, how are you?
Great, Michael.
Good. Hey, you know, I've just realized something. I'm on the phone with the both of you, and you're both Guggenheim fellows.
Oh, wow.
Great news. Congratulations.
Well, we have the secret handshake and the special decoder ring that we...
Right, exactly.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So we were listening to The Whole Tree Gone with your band Be Bread, Kung Fu, and Ben Goldberg, Brandon.
Yep,
Stomu.
Matt. Yep.
Great band.
Yeah, super fun to play with.
What's going on in that tune exactly?
Well, it's, you know, it's one of these, it's kind of a form I've explored in various contexts over the years, and it's, I would say it's sort of episodic in that we never really return. You know, it's through composed in the sense that we don't return to information, but we, you know, open it up periodically every few measures for some kind of solo improvisational exploration of the material. Mm-hmm. And it's a piece that I was able to feature everyone sort of individually or in duets throughout the piece and, you know, cover, move through a lot of territory that all grew out of the same initial measure or two of music that I wrote, but kind of looking at it lots of different ways and creating spaces for everybody in the band to bring their own voice into it, but still kind of have it fit within this architecture that hangs together and culminates in this, you know, great collective cacophony.
And that's one of the things that I remember from having been in your band was how, like you said, episodic development of the material that in a way doesn't change, but sort of keeps moving forward and allows everybody to jump in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is something that you've used this sort of idea or approach to composing that you used for a long time. Yeah. This goes back to the Same River Twice band for sure.
Well, and even before, you know, when probably to, not so much with the trio with Lindsay and Reggie, but certainly by the time I did that extended ensemble project with Dave and Marty Ehrlich, that I think that was already starting to inform the way I was writing.
That Henry Threadgill in some sense inspired you to work that way, or would that, I mean, of course he's influenced all of us,
right?
But I mean, in that in particular, do you feel like a connection there?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, Henry was the first person that I really sort of took what you might call formal composition lessons from, and he introduced me to a lot of ideas that I think, you know, I don't think I ever really employed them in the same way as Henry, but he got me thinking about material and form, and certainly this idea that the form grows out of the material was something that Henry talked about a lot, but, you know, it also resonated with you know, what I knew of Frank Lloyd Wright, for instance, having grown up in one of his houses, and, you know, his idea that the house or the building grows out of the site, you know, starting with a sort of initial motif, but not really imposing a structure, certainly a box-like structure, but really, you know, allowing the form of the building to be a part of the environment it's in. And that made a lot of sense to me as an improviser who I wanted to compose for improvisers and give them, you know, a structure. I it's that fine line between being a composer, like how much freedom do you give your players when you're composing for improvisers? Wanting to have sort of a vision that people could create with me, but still allow people's individual voices and forms of expression to inform that structure.
I never knew that that was your connection to Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, I know, there was that great piece.
Right.
Frank Lloyd Wright goes west to rest.
That's right. And we, you know, I played that piece for quite a while, explored it with the trio with Lindsay and Reggie. I did it as a solo piece. I performed it as a duet with Marilyn Crispell eons ago, and then eventually did it with the extended ensemble.
I would like to talk about that album, Above Blue.
Okay.
If you don't mind. I first heard that album on the radio, and I was living in Toronto, Canada at the time. And I was so knocked out by that, that I literally got on my bike and rode to the record store in downtown Toronto and bought it. And then spent an entire summer listening to that. I really have to say, especially, you know, in terms of the instrumentation and the harmonic language and also how you arranged things on that album, that was a pivotal album for me. And I would love to hear your thoughts about what was happening with that band and why you picked that instrumentation and those players.
Yeah, well, you know, I think for me, it's always sort of like one thing leads to the next. I had done that extended ensemble and was really trying to think, well, this isn't, you know, I've got some other ideas in mind. How am I going to get to that? And a crucial thing is always for me who the players are. And the second thing is, you know, what kind of ways can I start to change up some of the roles maybe that people are playing? Mm-hmm. And having Eric Friedlander play cello instead of having a bass player in the band really started to open up some possibilities for me. I mean, Eric is amazing and can really cover a kind of bass function, but can also play melodically, and that sort of freed up some room on the low end of the spectrum for me to play, you know, the full range of the piano. So that's kind of what I was thinking about, musical personalities and changing up the functions somewhat. And I have to say, I learned a ton from playing in that band. Everybody brought such great ideas to things. So, you know, I might come in with an initial idea, but I really enjoyed having the individual players in that band also put their own ideas forth about how we might arrange things. So it was really a very collaborative band for me.
say, like the way that Same River Twice band was collaborative, that when you work with Mark Dresser and Matt Wilson in the trio M, that the collaboration works the same way, or is that more driven by each person's compositions that they bring in?
You know, I think it's a little of both. I think we all have a real respect for the fact that we're different composers and our music is in some ways quite different from one another, but it seems to complement each other. And at the same time, I think we give each other a lot of liberties to interpret the music in the way that feels right to us. So if I brought in a piece that, say, I had played with another band, I wouldn't expect that the arrangement or the approach to the improvising would necessarily be the same with Trio M.
Hmm.
And we seem to have a great sort of intuitive connection, so that we talk very little about arranging, actually. We'll play the material, but then when we get on the bandstand, we won't necessarily know who's going to start it, or, you know, what's going to happen first, or who's going to solo, or even if we'll have individual solos. And then sometimes a piece will kind of find its way and we'll play it that way for a few nights. And then, you know, 5 nights later, all of a sudden it, you know, we take a completely different approach.
Wow.
So there's a lot of trust.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of having each other's backs, you know, yeah. willingness to go with whatever direction somebody takes it on a given night.
So this song, The Guest House, is that's your composition, right?
That's right, yeah.
Can you talk about how that came together, that particular arrangement?
Yeah, well, the thing is, we, Trio M, I have this program at Cal where I teach where we're fundraising primarily to be able to do more sort of programs, master classes, lessons, all kinds of stuff for jazz and improvisational music. Which is a fairly new addition to the department. And that on top of the fact that the California budget, until I read in the newspaper today that we're doing a little better.
Right, you have a surplus suddenly.
Yeah,
isn't that great?
How did that happen?
Yeah. I think just somebody's calculator was broken or something.
Yeah, no doubt.
Bizarre.
Anyway, so I realized that we needed to raise some money, and one of the things that I put together this student committee, and one of the things that we did was to do a benefit concert at a private house here in Berkeley that many people know is the Maybeck House, where all those great recordings were made, and at the time it was owned by a guy named Greg Moore, and he said, yeah, come over and use the house, and so I invited Trio M and this wonderful chef here in the Bay Area named Paul Canales. You may know him.
I love Paul Canales.
Yeah. Used to work at Olivetto, and now he's opened this wonderful new Basque tapas place in Oakland, which is also a venue.
And what's that called?
Duende.
Oh, great.
That's a great
yeah.
name.
You've been playing there, and a lot of people, I guess. That's
yes.
fantastic.
Yeah, it's like filled this need that we've had in the Bay Area for a venue that really embraces all kinds of music, you know.
And that's in Oakland.
Right, on 19th Street.
Great.
And anyway, so I went in to talk to Paul thinking, well, maybe I'll see if he'll cater an event. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I'd be happy to do that, but I'd really rather collaborate with you. Let's do a whole evening around improvisation and food and music. And so what we did was...
Why didn't you call me? My mouth is watering as you're telling this story. So
yeah.
What happened?
So anyway, we set up this little thing where each of us, Mark, Matt, and I, sent Paul sketches of music we were working on, or, you know, an improvisation we'd just recorded, and he responded with recipes and photos of food he'd just put together that he felt was inspired by listening to our ideas. We had this great dialogue, and by the time we did the concert, each of us had written a couple pieces, and one of the pieces I had written for that evening was The Guest House. And, you know, partly because, you know, it's informed by all kinds of stuff, but Paul is such a generous person and such a, so enthusiastic about everything, and was, you know, it donated all the food and wine for this event.
Wow.
We invited people. It was quite, you know, it was a sliding scale, but some people, you know, spent several hundred dollars to come to this event, and served them, you know, a course of food and then played some music. And this went on, you know, alternating those two things all evening, and had a great discussion with them about improvisation. And it was a wonderful event. Yeah.
But what was the menu item that was tied to this particular song?
If well, there wasn't... pork, that literally.
Oh, okay.
It might have been something to do with pork, and I don't, but I don't remember exactly.
Well, okay, that's good. We'll listen to that, and we'll think about pork.
It seems to me that you draw a lot of influences from sources outside of music. You
know, yes, that's really true.
Yeah.
Visual art, architecture. Yeah. For some reason, that's, you know, I feel like as much as I love to listen to all different kinds of music, trying to imitate someone else's music has never been my forte. And I think I found that responding to other kinds of art really gave me a way in that freed me up from that sense that, oh, I need to sound like this if I'm a jazz musician, or, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it usually starts with this kind of recognition or a sense of being moved by something, but also recognizing something of myself in somebody else's artwork. And then, you know, creating, I guess I can only call it a response, you know.
Right.
Like this dialogue has been set up, and my response is the natural way for me to respond is through music.
So that would be like a phrase, or like an overall shape of a form, or a gesture.
More likely to start with a gesture, a phrase, a set of, you know, harmonies that seem to somehow fit, and then again, you know, sort of allowing, as I work with that material, allowing the form to come out of that. The very core of what I'm doing, or why I'm pursuing music, is in a sense a spiritual path. You know, like that somehow the practice of music, either as a player or an improviser or a composer, is, or a professor, is really to realize, you know, I don't know how to talk about it in ways that aren't sort of grandiose, but to realize myself, or to try to fulfill, you know, like this, what a great opportunity to be alive, and how do I make the most of this? And it feels like music has always been the thing that's kind of leading me. There's been lots of other things along the way. It's led me to discover martial arts and meditation, and now I'm have the great fortune to be going on pilgrimage with some Huichol Indians in the central highlands of Mexico.
Wow.
But it's all kind of the same thing, and somehow the music seems to be central to all of it. You know, that's kind of saying, okay, you know, this is the next thing in your journey or whatever.
Hmm. But it sounds to me like the music is almost an observation. You know, we were using the word response a moment ago.
Right.
But it's kind of like you're observing what's around you
and musically, yeah, making a statement.
Not describing it, but, you know, being a part of it.
Exactly. I was going to say it's more like communing with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, the more that I'm able to tap into that, the more I can sort of trust that to guide me as an artist. And as much as I like to use my mind to help me, it feels like it's really more in service of that now than, you know, than this sort of intellectual ideas.
So this piano solo thing, is that your next release that's coming out? Or?
Yes, it is. Yep. It's coming out on Firehouse 12 in October. October 22nd, I think, is the release date.
Great.
And I'm excited because we're going to release it on vinyl as well as, you know, CD and download. So I'm really excited about it.
Was it recorded at Firehouse 12?
Yes, it was.
Such
in January.
Such a beautiful space.
Yeah, I love that place, and I love the piano, and I really like working with Nick Lloyd, the engineer.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with both of you.
Yeah. I hadn't heard Above Blue in many years, and it was a pleasant surprise to go back and hear it again.
That's a gem.
Yeah.
For sure, that's a gem.
Oh, thanks, you guys. Well, Dave, you take an amazing solo on that. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, Myra. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Music of Myra Melford. Great to hear her. Great to talk to her.
Yeah. Amazing person. Great artist. You are listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. And if you like what you're hearing, please do stop by the iTunes store and leave a comment. That'll help other people find out who we are and where we are and what we're doing.
And there's a dedicated page for the podcast at greenleafmusic.com, and you can see and hear all the episodes there.
Amongst many, many other things, the happenings at Greenleaf
right.
Music.
And you can write to us, podcast@greenleafmusic.com, and if you have suggestions or comments or thoughts. So I was thinking about street performing, which is something that I spent a lot of years doing, from 1984 when I first came to New York until about 86, 87.
Really? So you were performing in subway stations?
No, mostly outside. It was with bands.
Nice.
The first weekend I was in New York, Kermit Driscoll and Carol Chaikin and Mark Lambert and a few friends invited me to go play, and we played at the entrance to the Central Park Zoo across from the plaza.
Yeah, of course.
And then I met a whole world of people who were playing in the street, including Vincent Herring and Billy Newman and Charles Davis and eventually Bruce Cox and, you know, all kinds of great musicians. And I was doing that while I was studying with Carmine Caruso and going to NYU. And, you know, it was before they started cracking down so hard that you really couldn't
play. Like their licenses and stuff like that.
Yeah, so we would play at Times Square, and we'd play at Astor Place and City Hall, and 45th and 6th was one of my favorite spots.
There's some great, great music in the streets of New York, and probably always has been.
I still hear great folks.
And I'd imagine you learn a lot in terms of how to keep an audience.
Well, I was thinking about this in the context of something that I heard on one of those TED talks. Amanda Palmer was talking about how street performing was the precursor to her career with Kickstarter. And how, you know, the idea of playing in the street and, you know, giving something to someone and feeling free to ask for something in return was her inspiration for this enormous story about her Kickstarter campaign. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate controversy, where she then asked people in the towns that she was going to play at to come up and play with her for free.
Yeah.
And so it was
another story, right?
I don't really want to go there, but she was talking about street performing, and it triggered some memories for me about how much I did learn out in the street, you know, playing hard and having to really keep it exciting and compelling and, you know, and not stupid, not showy. I mean, you know, okay, you know, you could take off all your clothes. Maybe not in my case, but,
or wear a Muppet outfit or something, maybe.
Yeah, I don't mean that so much. I mean on purely musical terms.
Sure.
You know, what is it that really grabs a listener?
So what is it in your experience?
Well, I think it's just something that you see in a very obvious and visceral level when you're playing on the street. And some of the greatest days of learning that I had, maybe even unbeknownst to me at the time, was going from a one-hour lesson with Carmine Caruso out to play 4 hours with a band with electric guitar and bass on the street, you know, and trying to bounce my sound off the buildings on the opposite side of the street. And I think no matter how abstract your musical idea may be, you know, keeping it like to the point, to the
clarity.
Core, and not getting distracted by ideas or, you know, something that needs to be explained, maybe, let's say, you know, just like really having the idea be clear and front and center and putting it out there seems to be something that I still stick with in the music that I write and that I play. So this will make you laugh since you're originally from Canada, eh? So last time...
Oh, no.
We're not going to really go there. But, okay, last time I was staying in Vancouver, I was at the Georgia Court Hotel, which is right across from, what is that enormous arena where the hockey games...
Rogers Arena.
Is that what it is?
I think that's what it's called, yeah.
And so there was this saxophone player out in front of the arena all day long
as
the fans were arriving for some game. And I don't really follow hockey that much. I, you know, there was some game happening and this saxophone player was out in front busking, playing solo. And he's playing the same melody over and over and over. And it was like, it must have been the Don Cherry composition, the theme from Hockey Night in Canada.
Yeah, I don't think Don wrote that, but you know, I am Canadian. I am a hockey fan, and Could you sing it?
You're gonna like check me here? Yeah, I'm gonna get beat up.
We haven't figured out if it is in fact.
It's the song that goes. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-dee.
Yep, I know it
and
well.
And so, like, he
I've
played
been listening
it.
To that for the record since 1975.
And I had never heard it before. But he played, I swear, it was like 3 hours, and that was all he played. And, you know, in a way, like what we're talking about, playing on the street. He kept his message straight and direct. Well, and I will never forget it in my life. And it was just one afternoon.
But he also knows where his bread is buttered.
I guess so. I went off to the sound check, and he was still playing it. So I don't know how long he did it. But that is persistence. So it goes... But up, but up, but be, but up, but up, but be, right? But up, but up, but be, exactly. That was what it was.
And for the record,
hockey
that was not rehearsed.
Yeah, clearly.
Okay, before we sign off, we've been doing this on again, off again segment on inventions, future inventions that everyone's been waiting for.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
And I have a bit of a list. This is not stuff that I necessarily advocate, but it's stuff that everybody's been waiting for, sort of a la the Jetsons. And
so what is today's future invention that we're all waiting for?
I'm thinking food in pills. So, you know...
So instead of having to eat food...
Yeah, you'd take a pill, it would open up in your stomach, you'd get all your nutrients, and maybe fill you up. I don't know if there'd be like... It'd be like a zip file.
Right, but what about the taste, the flavor?
I don't know if taste is really a factor. I mean,
Yeah, but then people are going to take the pill and then still eat a meal because they need to have something delicious.
That might be true. That might be true.
I don't know.
But think about this. So you're on the road and... Yeah. You're in Europe, and it always happens. You're on the train. You check into the hotel. It's 2 o'clock. You're starving. Oh. Everything's closed.
Yeah.
And then you have to wait around till soundcheck. Then you go to soundcheck, and then you soundcheck, and you're starving and grumpy. There's
not enough time.
Yeah. And then you have to go and eat. So you don't eat.
That's when you whip out the pills in the in the backstage area and feed the band.
You know, it might.
That's a rough. That's okay. Thank you, Michael. Listen to another episode of the Greenleaf Music Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Yep. And again, stop by the iTunes store and let us know what you think. We will talk to you all soon. You've been listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast with Dave Douglas and Michael Bates.